very kind of characteristic of the human condition. And a couple of people came up to me during the week going, oh, wow, yeah, I'm doing that. Wow, it is. Just, you know, a couple of people did have experiences. So I just wanted to hear back and see if anybody has anything they want to share about kind of their experience checking this list of six. And the people that said something to me, if nobody else says anything, I'm going to call them. Your friends can help you out by piping up. Any reflections on this list of six or any of the other lists or how you kind of related to this during the week? Yeah, Rodrigo, right?
Fernando.
Okay.
coming up was a pattern, just repeating the same thing over and over, regardless of what I was focusing on. I've had enough while I have time here on this earth to repeat the pattern over and over and over. And it still feels close to the same as it did 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The get caught up in the maelstrom of work, life, whatever, when you just having to experience the water, that feeling of just hold on, make it, and it still comes back almost exactly the same way.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You just, like, when you realize that, you're just like, really? Again? You know, over and over and over again, sort of thing. Thank you. And how does it make you feel to realize that?
Like I'm up in circles.
Yeah. It's exhausting, isn't it, when you realize that? And that's why I finished the meditation with the promise, because I didn't want to drag you guys through suffering for 20 minutes without kind of the carrot at the end of the stick of there it is. A solution to it. But first we have to realize, and that's why the noble truths are presented in the order that they are. You know, it's not that the suffering comes first, it's caused by something, but we need to realize it first, or else we're not going to put energy into the path. You know, and the metaphor often given is, you need to know that you have a disease before you're going to make an appointment and go to the doctor, right? So it's like, that's why I drag you through this, and I'm sorry, and I apologized last week, and I'm going to apologize again for, you know, dragging you through. But we need to really tune into that and then just go, whoa, I just keep doing it again and again and again. And how much, you know, it's amazing. And I shared the story of, like, even after I'd been studying Buddhism for a while, how I still thought, oh, this thing in my life is kind of messed up, and as soon as I fix that, it's going to be smooth sailing. It's ridiculous, you know, knowing better, but not really knowing better, still doing it, still reacting in that way. Yeah. Thank you, Fernando. Thank you for sharing. Yeah. Anybody else? Ryan, can I call on you? Because you were talking about it.
Yeah. I was kind of seeing the dissatisfaction coming up a lot, so... satisfaction of not really being content with just whatever state that I was at. So, like, in my yoga practice, like, thinking, like, oh, if I do these certain poses, then I'll get this to happen in my body, and, like, then I'll be happy,
yeah.
You know? So, like, really, or, like, oh, if I buy this book, and then I read this information, and then I finally get it, you know, and then I'll be just constantly kind of, like, striving. Not really being in the present moment, but just being like, oh, it's not quite right, and I'm trying to figure out how to make it right.
Yeah. And it drives, I mean, like I was saying, this impulse of, like, just one more thing, and then I'll get it right. And that's what we call life.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, like, what we do. It's interesting. I think one of the advantages of long meditation retreats, and I really noticed this in one place when I was in retreat, and we could give the caretakers notes once a week. I think it was like the notes went in this little 5-gallon bucket down the hill, lashed to a tree, with your grocery list and whatever you wanted. And so Tuesday at noon, and then they would go shopping Wednesday and deliver Wednesday by 5, some time frame like this. So I would notice myself, you know, I'd be studying something or meditating, and it would be like Thursday afternoon, and I'd just go, oh, I'd read a footnote in a book or the bibliography of something I was studying, and it would refer to a book, and I was like, oh my God, if I get this book, I'll be enlightened by next Tuesday, like, for sure. And then it was like, okay, they can do, like, Amazon overnight delivery. Well, the post office is, like, 30 miles away. Well, that's okay. They'll just wait. I'll make them wait for it until it comes, and then they can bring it back. You know, and I'd have this impulse of this thing that I needed. But it was only Thursday, and the note, they only picked up the note on Tuesday. So I'd write furiously the note and put it with, you know, my grocery list and this whole thing. And by the time I was getting everything ready to put in the bucket on Tuesday morning, I'd pull out the note and be like, what was that? I didn't even know. What book? Whatever. Like, and I realized, like, in normal life, you know, there's sort of this sine wave, and, like, the impulse starts to get steep. You know, the desire. And we just act on it because we can. Especially now online, you can get whatever you want in like 24 hours. So it's like the craving sort of peaks, and then mostly we act on it. And what I noticed, because I couldn't, was it's a sine wave. And it peaks, and if you don't follow it, it just peters out. And then, you know, so I think that's part of our meditation practice is just watching it, right? Being mindful of it and not just following every impulse. Because mostly what we do, we're following it the minute the slope hits, what is it, rise over run, remember, like, you know, high school. The minute the slope gets really steep, we're off to the next thing. And that's what we're doing all the time. We're like, what's going to make me feel good? Yeah, the next thing, next thing, next thing. And if we just, like, stop, if we just, like, shut it down and chillax, like, it'll just, you know, and then you'll be like me. By Tuesday morning, you'll be like, yeah, whatever, I don't even know what that is. But we don't, you know, we don't. But watching it, like, the first step is just even tuning in and watching that impulse and just go, wow, check it out. I'm just doing it all the time, like you say, you know. If only this, if only that, if only that, if only that. And then that just drives most of our actions of body, speech, and mind. And we never really get it. We just never get the satisfaction. We just spend so much energy and never really get the satisfaction that we're seeking. Yeah. So Lord Buddha said, just forget it. It's great. Just give it up. It's never going to work anyway. You know, so we can just give up that endless search. Anybody else have anything to share about your reflections last week on the question of dukkha dissatisfaction?
Yes. Well, I wasn't here last week, but yes. I have nuggets in my life now. Through this fact, trying to learn a little more about suffering, that sometimes even what it gives you happiness in a moment or a good, and then you attach too much. That thing that you wanted too much and you got it.
Yeah.
You're suffering because you attached too much.
Yeah.
Then I'm afraid to lose it.
Yeah.
Or let it go.
Yeah.
And even what we love or something gives you suffering.
There's always an enlightened being in the room that gives a sneak preview of what the teacher's going to talk about. And tonight we're going to talk about attachment and the other mental afflictions, because you're absolutely right. Like, even you get what you thought you wanted, and you finally do get it, and then there's the suffering of attachment. So we'll talk about that tonight. Yeah, that's exactly the topic. Yeah. Anybody else have any reflections? Yes, please.
I think the second one from the bottom, like how I use Facebook, you know, when I go there and I get a lot of likes on something I post, I think that's high status. I feel good.
Yeah.
And then when I go there and I don't get all the feedback that I want, then I feel a little low.
Right.
And I wonder if that maps to what that is.
Oh, I think so, for sure. Like, we're always seeking that status. I read a book that came out maybe 6 months ago or something, and it's called Irresistible, and it's about technology addiction. And it's so fascinating. And they're talking about how these designers design in exactly those kind of things to keep you hooked in. And a lot of it is that. a lot of it is either about like some sense of community or some sense of getting a feeling of status from what you're doing. Because they said like Facebook was just this thing at Harvard until they put the like buttons on it. And then it just completely exploded. It's so interesting, like the psychology of how they design these things. And that's exactly, and then you get obsessive about it, don't you? It's like, I have a friend, and her daughter, who's a teenager, called her in tears. I was visiting her, called her mom hysterical because she posted a picture like 45 minutes before and nobody liked it yet. And then she went to low status, like, they think I'm stupid, they think my picture was stupid, you know, so it's just, I mean, we have that, but I think some of this technology, lets it, it just goes crazy, doesn't it? It's amazing, yeah, yeah, but I think it's that, like, we crave the high status, and so it's like, we're not just doing that from life to life. Nowadays with Facebook, we're doing it every post, you know, or every time we log on, or you know, I went off it after the election. I was so triggered, I just had to like shut it down. I'm so happy I did. Never going back on. But yeah, yeah, that's exactly how. Yeah.
It's been the technology. Matt in Rhode Island is very grateful for these teachings and keeps sending you lots of loving hearts.
Hi, Matt.
I got even more of
them. Hey, Matt. Wow, that seems a place for us. Awesome. Okay. So what I wanted to start unpacking, and this is going to take a, you know, at least tonight and next week, if not longer, is the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of suffering or the cause of suffering, because by really understanding that well, the path makes sense, right? The Buddhist path, sometimes we get into Buddhism and we start meditating and we do this practice and that practice and the other practice. And I found, you know, and a lot of the Tibetan lamas, I had one teacher, Geshe Jumpa Tekchok, and he used to always say, you Western people, like you modern people, you're really educated. You need to understand why. He would say, I can tell the Tibetan monks something and just out of like, devotion to me, they'll just do it. He's like, y'all don't do that. You need to know why. And that's good. Like, he was like, that's great. Because then when you do it, you're into it. You know, he goes, if you're just doing it to please me, then one day you're mad at me, you won't do your practice. But if you're doing your practice because you understand why you're doing it, then it makes sense. And so for me, really unpacking the truth of the cause, and then looking at how our practices relate to like short circuit creating suffering is awesome, because then it just all makes sense. You know, it's logical, and then you'll do your practice. So, cheerleading. So we're going to look at this flow chart that keeps showing up over and over and over again. Most of you haven't heard me teach much. By the time you've heard me teach for a year or two, you'll be so tired of this flowchart. But it just explains everything. David is tired of the flowchart. He's the one that he knows exactly where I'm going, don't you, David? So this is the flowchart. And I'm sorry, I've changed my... I'm the recycling queen, so I've reused these over and over again. And then I changed my translation, so sorry about that. It's a little bit messy. I should take like white out, if they even make it anymore, which they probably don't. Correct. So this is showing... Here you can see the first noble truth, the truth of suffering or dukkha or dissatisfaction, right? We talked about that alternative translation. And then the truth of the origin of suffering. So how is this caused? Because it's the result of causes. It's not random. It's not that an omnipotent supreme being is testing you or punishing you or anything like that, right? These are some of the views that were held at the time of Lord Buddha. There's views that people have now. Oh, what happens to me? There's nothing I could do about it. I'm just a helpless victim of random events, and I just need to figure out how to cope with them. Right? I mean, this is a common view. Or some people, you know, God is doing it to test me, or I'm being punished, or whatever. Neither of these are Buddhist views. Buddhist view says, everything that happens happens to you is a result of causes. So cause and effect, so fundamental to Buddhism. So how does that chain reaction of causation work? And we're going to look at each step of this in a lot of detail in the next two sessions, because like I said, by really understanding it well, you'll be able to undo it. Because that's the whole point. We don't want this, right? Get rid of that. And the way we do that is short-circuiting this chain reaction leading to this result by getting rid of the causes. Okay, so we're going to unpack this messy, I should really redo it with all the right translations, but I know you guys don't want to. So, at the very top of the chart, and this shows up at the very top of a lot of charts, and in fact, another one we're going to look at in this class we call the 12 links, and ignorance is the first step of that one, too. So, ignorance, what kind of ignorance do you think this is? Is it just, I don't know, I don't speak Japanese. That's a certain kind of ignorance. Is that what we're talking about? What kind of ignorance are we talking about? I see some head shaking. Heather and Pamela, what kind of ignorance are we talking about? There's two main flavors of ignorance. So
wrong worldview?
What does that mean?
Not seeing things as empty. Thinking that things have their characteristics coming at me from their own side. That no matter who's looking at this, they're going to see a little TV tray or a little tray that I do homework on, no matter who look at this and what era and what time of being. We don't need archaeologists to tell us anymore what it is, because everybody that looked at this would always see a TV tray.
Yeah, so that's the main kind of ignorance. Well done, gold star. That's the main kind of ignorance, and we'll talk a lot more about that. We'll kind of put it to the side. I'll give you the 1040 EZ form, too, which you did well. It's basically there's a dichotomy between the way things exist and the way they appear. And we believe the appearance is the way they exist, right? So we're always believing that exactly the way things appear to us is the way they exist. And in Buddhism we say, no, until a very high level of realization, there's a dichotomy there, right, that things don't exist in the way that they appear to us. And as Pamela so brilliantly, as a well-studied Buddhist student, said, they seem like they exist from their own side, by their own nature, right? There are a lot of synonyms to this appearance. My perception has nothing to do with it. That's just the way that it is for everybody, and from its own side, that's what it is, right? And so Buddhism says, it's a little more complicated than that, and we'll talk about that as we kind of go along in the course. But that believing that things exist in exactly the way they appear to us, we'll see, is a big problem. It's a big problem. Now, there's another related flavor of ignorance that comes up when we talk about ignorance. Can anybody think, Heather, what were you going to say? Was that what you were to say, that one?
I was, not in so many words, but I was going to say not understanding why things happen.
Yeah, and that's the other flavor, is an ignorance about cause and effect, right? So those two are related, and we'll see why. But ignorance about cause and effect, right? Thinking things are random, thinking an omnipotent being is making it happen. That ignorance is another flavor that's a troublemaker. So those are the two main troublemakers, ignorance about cause and effect and ignorance about the what we call sometimes in Buddhist philosophy, the ultimate nature of reality. But for now, let's just think of it as that dichotomy between the way things exist and the way they appear, and we'll talk a lot more about that. So then that gives rise, and I used to call these afflictive emotions, and then I started studying emotions from a Western psychological standpoint, and I realized that was really inaccurate. The Sanskrit word is klesha, the Tibetan word is nyomo, and mental affliction is better, right? Because the definition of this, and in fact I heard Alan Wallace recently, who's a great translator, and he said he prefers now mental afflictor, not even mental affliction, but mental afflictor, which is kind of nuanced but also interesting. And these are defined as mental events that are disturbing to your peace of mind.
Okay.
Matt wonders if that would be the same thing as desires.
We'll get there, Matt. Hang on. Stay up until make another cup of coffee now. So, mental events that are disturbing to your peace of mind. And this gets really interesting, and the reason I scratched out emotions is because it doesn't correlate exactly to the what we think of when we think of emotions in Western psychology. Now, there's a lot of overlap between the two categories. So we've got mental afflictions or mental afflictors, kleshas. We've got emotions. You know, even the category of disturbing emotions, because, of course, not all emotions are disturbing or destructive emotions, but there's not complete overlap. There's a lot of overlap. The anger family of emotions shows up on both lists. But the interesting thing is, usually when we talk about destructive emotions or disturbing emotions in Western psychology, we're saying things that are destructive to our own and others' well-being, right? Whereas in Buddhism, the perspective is, this is disturbing to my peace of mind. Why do you think there's such a difference? Why does Buddhism emphasize so much disturbing to your peace of mind rather than disturbing to your own and others' well-being necessarily? Any guesses? What happens when your peace of mind is disturbed? What can't you do very well?
Think. Care about anybody else.
And I'll give you a hint. Meditating. So, mental afflictions completely mess up your meditation, right? So we say in Buddhism, our meditation practice, deep meditation, is how we get the realizations of the path. So things that mess up your meditation, that's why the focus in Buddhism, yes, we care in Buddhism about hurting other people, yes, we care about, you know, these other things, but the lens that we're looking at these things through is, does it mess up your meditation or not? Right? So, one of the things that is on the list of mental afflictions that nobody would really consider to be a destructive emotion is a mental affliction we call excitement, which means just thinking about a pleasant object a lot, just fantasizing about your vacation in Hawaii. It doesn't really hurt anybody. Right? It doesn't really hurt you. It doesn't hurt anyone else. What does it do to your meditation, David?
Oh, it just derails it.
Yeah.
It's flypaper.
Yeah, exactly. So that's really interesting. When you look, there's a list of 26 of these in the textbooks on Buddhist psychology, right? There's 26 mental afflictions or kleshas. And a lot of them, like I say, there's a lot of overlap to what we would call destructive emotions, but not 100%. There are a lot of these that are just will mess up your meditation, even though they're not really destructive or disturbing to your own and others' well-being. So a different lens of looking at that. So that's cool, which is why I scratched out emotion, because I was like, no, that's a false equivalence that I'm not going to talk about. But you will sometimes hear the Sanskrit word klesha translated as, yeah, afflictive emotion, even disturbing emotion. You will hear some translators translate it as emotion, but it's not super accurate, okay? So we're going to talk tonight about two of the major ones, attachment and aversion. But any questions so far about what we've done so far before we start unpacking the definitions of attachment and aversion? Anything to clarify before we start? Okay. Well, let's do one of them before the break. Do you want attachment or aversion? Let's do attachment. Let's start attachment, because attachment's a long story. So we'll start it, and then I'll give you a break, and then we'll come back. So there is a Buddhist rumor, Matt, that wanting anything is not okay. Anybody heard this Dharma rumor?
Matt says yes.
Not okay. Not okay to want stuff, right? It's really important to understand the exact definition of attachment which is not the same as wanting. It's not even the same as desire. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama really differentiates the words for attachment and the word for desire. So let's talk about it. When I say attachment, what are some of the kind of characteristics of attachment, or what comes up for you when I say the word attachment? Just any qualities of attachment, characteristics of attachment?
Clinging.
Clinging. Okay, clinging.
Family.
Well, not examples of what we're attached to, but qualities of attachment. So clinging.
Obsession.
Obsession.
Jealousy.
Okay. Let's put that on hold for a minute. We'll go back to that. Yeah.
Dependence.
Okay, dependence, obsession, clinging.
Stickiness.
Yeah. How do you think ignorance might play in? Because look at this. We've got an arrow coming down.
Trickle down James, ignorance?
Did you have trickle?
No.
Yeah.
Wet in my head.
Okay. Always throws me off. I had a student who had this beard, and he was constantly playing with his beard, and I'd just catch this hand out of my peripheral vision, and he'd be... How does it relate to ignorance, do you think? How does it relate to that thing that there's that gap between the way things exist and the way they appear to us?
The way we saw the attachment.
How are we seeing it? How are we seeing the object of
possession? It can be like something you desire so much that you want it to be used forever because you're thinking, your ignorance is telling you that that's going to give you something that you want.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of it, for sure. So that there's another aspect of wanting to possess it, thinking that it'll give us lasting happiness. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so the official definition of attachment, you guys ready for this? Okay? So, perceiving an object as pleasant or attractive, okay, so perceiving something as pleasant or attractive, that, no big problem yet. Okay? Just wait for it. Then, the second component is exaggerating the pleasant qualities of the object. And then thinking that by possessing and retaining that object, you'll have lasting happiness. That's the official Buddhist definition of attachment, which sounds like a setup for what? Serious disappointment, right? Is that a good idea? All of that exaggeration, all of that distortion? No way. So at this point, I was asked, has anybody ever fallen in love? You know, the Buddhist nun, the only one. Okay. So what do? You meet someone. You know, I remember, I think of an example of like, okay, the early 80s, long before I was a Buddhist nun, just full disclosure, don't want anybody to get the wrong idea, decades and decades ago. You know, and you meet the new guy, and he's perfect. Oh my God, Prince Charming. You know, we're brainwashed by all of the fairy tales. And so there's that phase that you're like, you know, kind of trying to get together, and then you get together, and he's like, oh my God, it's just perfect. And then you're hanging out for a while because you're like, you know, just joined at the hip for a couple of weeks or whatever. And then there comes the phase where you take him to introduce him to all your friends. Like, you break him out at a party, you know. And so you go to the party, and all your friends, and you're introducing your new boyfriend, and you're just like, they're like, nice to meet you. And, and then, you know, the next day you're checking with your friends, right? You're like, oh my God, he's amazing. And your friends are like, yeah, honey, he seems really nice. Do you want to go to the movies at 7 and have pizza before? And you're like, no, but isn't he amazing? So they're like, oh, you know, I'm so glad you're happy, but let's go. And you just think your friends are like blind and stupid, don't you? Because why don't they see what you see? And then, of course, we all know how it goes. And then you move in, and 6 months later, he leaves the toilet seat after the middle of the night, and can't stand the way he chews his food, and then it's all over, isn't it? The first week, just that shiny exaggeration, right? If you saw things in a balanced way, Right, but what are we doing now? Super sparkly, shiny. Like I said, I'm a Buddhist nun, but I have memory. That sparkly, shiny thing. And then you set yourself up for disappointment. You know, you go out with a Buddhist. This happened to me. One of my last boyfriends was a Buddhist, and he was like, you're just creating this projection of who you want me to be, and that's not who I am at all. It's like, don't ever date a Buddhist. They'll bust you. That's no fun. Let me have my projection. You know. It sets us up for disappointment. Whereas, and a lot of people say at this point, so what's the difference between attachment and love? Like, is it okay to love someone as a Buddhist? Yes, in fact, it's highly recommended. But we say love is like wishing the other person to have happiness. It's not, attachment is all about us. I need you to make me happy, and I'm going to exaggerate, and then you better stay forever so that I'll have happiness. Whereas we say love, the definition of love in Buddhism is wishing for the other person to have happiness, right? It's such a different dynamic. Now, most of our close relationships, it's a mixture, isn't it? Like, until a very high level of realization, it's not just 100%, oh, I want you to be happy, and then you don't care when your partner leaves you or whatever. It's a mixture. But, you know, I recommend a higher ratio of love to attachment if you really want to have happiness with your close relationships, because that kind of attachment, you know, where we're just clinging, is just a setup, because then we're so disappointed when things change, as they will, because Buddhism says they always do. No. Amanda, did you have your...
No.
You're just mulling. Let's have a break, and we'll come back. Let's just take maybe 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and talk more about attachment. There's a little bit more to unpack.
Only a little.
Hello, everyone. As some of you know, on the third Friday and the third Sunday of every month, we provide breakfast for people in Sacramento who would not otherwise have anything to eat. On Friday morning, we provide breakfast at Loaves and Fishes. We meet there at 7 a.m. at Friendship Park. We open our little breakfast for business at 7:30, and we're usually done by 8 or 8:15 a.m. We serve them a breakfast of hot oatmeal, hard-boiled eggs, fresh fruit, and whatever else happens to show up. We're still looking for people to help serve, and we actually could still use some food donations. So if you are interested, check out our Facebook page. There's information there on how to get to our sign-up. There's also information on our website, which is written on the board over there, or you can come talk to me directly after class. And we're always open to new service volunteers to come help and serve. And if you're cleaning out your closets and your dressers this time of year and getting rid of coats and sweaters and anything else that doesn't fit anymore or that you're just not using, travel mugs, reusable bags, anything like that, we'll take those as well. And we pass them out during the breakfast to people who need them. So anything like that is welcome. The drop-off point is right downtown on V Street between 17th and 18th on my front porch, and you just leave it up there and we take care of the rest. So thank you. Lauren, are you going to come up and talk about the rest of the stuff, or do you want me to keep going? Okay, we'll keep going. We're very fortunate to have Venerable Tenzin here teaching for March and a wee bit into April. So on Sunday mornings from 10 to 11:30, there's kind of an open discussion happening on Buddhism. So if you have, she's following a bit of a format, but also just really leaving it open for generalized discussion and questions. So that's a really beautiful opportunity to just sit in a small group and have a really in-depth conversation about various topics related to Buddhism. And then on Monday night, somewhat related to this class, Venerable Tenzin is also leading a meditation class. And all of our evening classes here at Diamond Light start at 6:30 p.m. and run until 8:30 p.m. So the evening classes I'm all going to talk about now will all be that same time frame. So our Monday evening actually ends a half hour earlier. I just totally lied. So on Monday nights, we get together for meditation for about an hour and a half, and we get a little bit of teaching, and then we sit for a while, a little bit of teaching, and we sit for a while. And so there's two or three sessions, and there's lots of opportunity to ask questions, and it's really a beautiful experience. And then Tuesday nights for the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Next 3 weeks, I think it is.
Till April
2nd. We'll be finishing through this curriculum for Buddhism, what is the name of the
nutshell.
Buddhism in a nutshell. That's the actual name, not Buddhism in a nutshell. I think I named it wrong on Periscope. Sorry, guys. But Buddhism in a nutshell, and she'll be continuing through the Four Noble Truths and an in-depth discussion of the Four Noble Truths. And then on Thursday night, we get a fresh new teacher. Thursday night, Sunil Joseph is continuing his series of nonviolent communication courses. And so they're also here from 6:30 to 8:30. It's a fresh new course starting for the next 4 weeks. And that's just a beautiful way to learn how to communicate with people in the world in a way that opens their hearts and minds rather than throwing up their defenses, including yourself, right? And I found it incredibly useful to just help keep me walking in a good way in the world. So selfishly, I'm not planting a lot of negative memory seeds for myself. And so then I'm just being kinder and more gentler with people out there in the world. And then the last and final and very, very important would be that we are a completely volunteer organization. Everything here is handled by volunteers. No one is paid. We offer whatever we can, small stipend, to visiting teachers to help them to get here. But the lights, the rent, everything is through the generosity and donation of those that come to study. So please, if you have it to give, we would graciously receive it. Never give more than you can comfortably give, because that can just breed as much bad karma as not giving any, right? If you have it to give and you don't, that came out wrong. But anyway, so there's a bowl. There's a couple of bowls at the back of the room, one for the center itself and another for the teacher. Just one bowl these days, I guess. One bowl out of the loop. Or like me, if you often travel with no cash and you like regular receipts and that kind of gizmo, you can go onto our website, diamondlightsac.org. You'll see the address in a minute, Periscope people. And you can donate through our website, and it's tax deductible. You'll get a receipt. And if you want to give regularly, there's a little box. You can check for a monthly donation, and then you don't even have to think about it anymore. And that's what I do because I forget. Anyway, I think that's it.
Great.
Was there anything else? Sorry to take so much time.
And for this class, for those of you that may just be joining, there's a handout that is available as a PDF that we can send to you. And I think, Lauren, if you see Lauren, if you don't have one already, and she'll set you up, or we can print them out for people who want a hard copy and don't have access to a printer. So that's just sort of some of the notes of the class and a suggested reading list and, a lot of the flip chart pages and all of that. Okay, back to attachment. So questions about attachment, either the definition or nuance, the difference between attachment and love, attachment and wanting things, anything that comes up about attachment.
Is it natural that if you are in a relationship with somebody and you love them, that you do become attached?
Well, I think it's very mixed in our, especially intimate relationships, right? Or friendships. Hopefully there's some desire for their happiness, but I think for sure for most of us, there's definitely a strong "I want you around because you're going to make me happy" aspect too. And so it's, I think it's a question of sort of awareness and just trying. I had a friend who was in a relationship. I'll tell two little stories that'll illustrate. So I had a friend who was in a relationship and it was this woman, and he met the perfect Dharma partner. Like, that happens, that people are looking for the perfect, like, Dharma relationship. So he met this woman and he was like, "Oh, and it's great. We really support each other's practice, because really all we want is to benefit all sentient beings and not to kind of grasp at each other, but just to support each other to help. So why are we in a relationship?" Kind of like the circular thing of talking yourself out of it. There was another man who came, this is years ago, I'll never forget. I was at Vajrapani Institute, where I'm living now. And the first time I lived there was the early 90s, and this man came to a teaching with our teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and he wanted an appointment, and I was the center director at that point, so I got him an appointment. And he goes, "Yeah, I need to talk to Rinpoche because my marriage just broke up and I need advice." And turned out his wife had left him for his best friend, like super, double betrayal, awful, broken heart. And he's like, "Oh, I need to talk to Rinpoche because the thing happened." And I was kind of like, you're sure you want to talk to Rinpoche about this? You know, so he goes to Lama Sopa Rinpoche and, like, tells the story. You know, he goes, and I was kind of waiting for him to come back because I had a feeling it may not go quite the way he planned. And so I spot him kind of coming back from the teacher's house, just looking a little shocked and bewildered. And I was like, how'd it go? He goes, well, you know, I started explaining to him, and I was like, Rinpoche, I was married for 20 years, and I was so in love, and my wife, and then, you know, my best friend, and then she went off with my best friend, and the mom said, goes, that's fantastic. Aren't you happy? Because you want all beings to have happiness. And then Lama Sopa goes, you enjoy her for 20 years. None of your best friend is enjoying her. I'm not quite there yet. And so it's one of those, because Lama Sopa's like, don't you want beings to have happiness? Like, what's the problem? So realistically, it's mixed for us, you know, but I think when it's only about us, I mean, then I think this is where love can turn to hate so quickly, like overnight. Like if it was really love, then the person dumps you or whatever, but it just turns so quickly, and that's when I think, okay, wait a minute, maybe it was mostly attachment, you know, and maybe not so much care and concern for the other people, but I think, like, we're human beings, so it's going to be mixed for a long time with all of our close relationships, whether it's intimate relationships or friendships. But just kind of being aware of it, I think, is really helpful. I think being aware of that exaggeration, just knowing that we're doing it, can be really helpful too. And then I think if relationships last, then you can see the person in a more balanced way and still appreciate the really good qualities. I think that thing when we're disillusioned and break up is when it was all so exaggerated and shiny, and then we're just devastated that, you know, the person didn't live up to our exaggerated projection. Like, whose fault is that? You know, as Lama Sopa says, you know, they didn't live up to our hallucination. Whose fault is that? So just kind of an awareness, because it's really going to be a, you know, very long time on the spiritual path before we're completely over attachment. Like, it's going to come up, but just kind of being more aware of it, I think, too. So the question comes, what about wanting things? What about desire? Not sexual desire, but just desiring things. What do you think? Is that okay if you're a Buddhist? What's the difference between desiring, wanting, and attachment? Sunil, you're nodding your head. Can I help you?
I'm learning how to be with you now. My interpretation. Yeah. My interpretation is when it gets to clinging, and if I'm holding it really tight, then I call it desire attachment. I don't want to live a life where it's like everything is gray and I don't feel any desire.
Yeah.
Even the desire to help somebody, that would not be a fun life. But when that gets obsessive, then I think it's unhealthy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's, you know, to me, like, the difference is there wisdom mixed in or ignorance? You know, that's the difference for me between attachment and desire. Does the Dalai Lama want all of us to be free from suffering? You bet. He still flies around the world. Like, he's 84 or something now. Like, punishing schedule. Why? Because he wants so badly to benefit beings. Right? So you can be passionate about things. You can care about things. You can desire things. But are you doing it with wisdom? With an understanding? Yes, I really want beings to be free from suffering. I know how to do it if you're the Dalai Lama. I'm going to put all of this incredible energy and passion into it, you know, and enjoy myself. By the way, if you've ever seen him eat dinner, he tucks in. He is moving, you know? But there's no clinging. Like, he can enjoy something and just immediately let go. You know, you can imagine. I mean, I have a friend who, for a long time, her father was the president of the Four Seasons hotel chain, like this super crazy five-star. So she would always organize her dad to offer the most amazing suite to His Holiness when he'd be in some town. But can you imagine? I mean, it's not like he, you know, was being driven off to the airport from the Four Seasons and he's kind of looking over his shoulder out of the back of the limousine going, oh, that was really nice. When is that going to happen again? You know? Like, that's kind of what we do with our enjoyment. It's like, when is it going to happen? You know, and whereas I think in Lama Yeshe, too, I had a friend who was the attendant of our teacher, Lama Yeshe, who enjoyed the heck out of everything, like so over the top, you know, just amazing, these great stories. But it was like, as Rick Hansen says, like Velcro and not, or Teflon and not Velcro, right? Like we can just, yeah, okay, my karma served me up some nice experience, awesome. Not happening anymore, no sweat, like that, which takes a while. But, you know, the passion and wanting things and enjoying things is fine. Our problem is, often when we really enjoy something, it's very Velcro and not very Teflon. You know, that's our problem. There is that element of clinging because we're mistaking the object as the cause of happiness. And that's the real ignorance, too, that gets us in trouble. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about the 12 links. It's not the object is the cause of our happiness, but we think it is. That's a big flavor of that ignorance. We mistakenly think the objects are the cause of our happiness, and they're not. They're a condition. So there's a difference between causes and conditions. Hold that thought. We'll talk about it more next week when we talk about karma. Any other questions about attachment, desire, wanting, enjoying, happy, pleasure? So the Buddhist rumor that to be a good Buddhist, you're sitting there stoically detached, like, oh no, no chocolate, thank you, no, no fruit tart, no, not having that. You know, it's not true. I mean, all you have to do is look at these great masters that are just like so joyful, you know, so in just enjoying everything. But it's that thing, it's without that grasping and clinging. That's the difference. Okay? So aversion, the next major flavor of mental affliction. What do you think the definition of aversion is now that you have been primed with the definition of attachment? What do you think about aversion? I won't embarrass you by calling on you. You can just call out. What are some of the aspects of aversion you think?
Avoidance.
Yeah, avoidance. Avoidance. So we're wishing to avoid?
Fear. That's part of it.
Okay. Fear.
Exaggerating bad qualities.
Yeah, yeah. So we're doing the same thing, aren't we? So the definition of aversion is really similar, except like 180 degrees, to the same component. So we're perceiving something as unpleasant, right? Exaggerating the unpleasant qualities of the object, and then thinking that by avoiding it, you know, by being separated from it, we're going to have lasting happiness, right? So it's just that exaggeration. You know, we often think of like the horrible boss. And he's like, you know, Friday afternoon, his kids run in the office and jump in his lap and kiss him and go, oh, daddy, daddy. And you're like, oh, God. Like, how can it? You know, and you hear he goes out for beers with his friends on Saturday night and you're like, friends? Yeah, like, oh. It's so exaggerated. We can't imagine this person having it. And so there's people like that that we've had in our life. I told this story, David's probably heard me tell. It was so striking. So I was flying home once from India to San Francisco, and I had to change planes in Seoul, in Korea, in the airport. And so we changed planes, and I got on a new plane. And I was so proud because I was traveling to India in the summertime with a day pack. Like when you're a nun, you don't have personal, you know, hair care products or blow dryers, you know, makeup, no, no, no. So I had like my spare robes in a day pack. So I had my little red day pack chucked in the bin. And this guy comes walking down the aisle. And even the way he walked down the aisle bugged me. And then he comes with his family. And then he opens the bin, and he's like, that's not our stuff. Whose red day pack is that? And I'm like, excuse me? I bought a ticket, too? Like, what? So So I'm already like just in total. And then he sits down next to his wife, who seems really nice, and then he's bugging her as she's trying to read the in-flight magazine. And then she gets up to go to the bathroom, and I was going to follow her. And he's like, get rid of it, Justin. But being a good person, I'm sitting there going, oh my God, wow, check it out. So much aversion. Wow. Like, so full on. So I didn't believe it. Like, it was super happening with this poor guy. You know, who knows what happened between us in some past life. That was the only explanation. But I couldn't believe my exaggeration. I was like, wow, check it out. It's so intense. He can't do anything right. Like, he got his meal then, and he was right in front of me. It was awful. So I couldn't. And then he got his meal, and something about the way he ate, and then he got the thing. So we've all had that experience, isn't it? Like somebody, and they can't do anything right. And you're so, it's just so much aversion. I was like, God, can I change seats? Like, wow, the floor's really full. It would be tormenting. But it was a great meditation for me because I was like, wow, check it out. It's so strong. And even though I know better, right? So that's the first step. You know better, but you still do it. But at least you know what you're doing. It's this weird schizophrenic thing. Phase of like knowing what you're doing, but while you're still doing it. Anybody? Yeah, there's a lot of nods from some of the people that are meditating. So aversion. So these two, plus ignorance. Sometimes we call them the three poisonous minds: ignorance, attachment, and aversion. And if we have more time, and maybe at some class in the future, we can look at the list of 26, which are in the text on Buddhist psychology of the mental afflictions. And it's really interesting. They're all some combination of ignorance, attachment, and aversion. And in the text, there's like these recipes, like jealousy. You asked about jealousy a little bit earlier. And jealousy is sort of like two parts of attachment, one part of aversion, and a healthy sprinkling of ignorance. So the mental afflictions are some combination, some of all three of the three poisons of ignorance, attachment, aversion. Some more to do with aversion, right? So we've got like a whole kind of anger family of mental afflictions. Belligerence is one. Resentment is one, right? So that's more of the aversion. They're all mixed with ignorance. You know, spoiler alert. Ignorance is in there always. But some are more on the attachment side or the aversion side. And some just relate to ignorance. But they're all like those. That's the recipe. Those three, right? So it's interesting to kind of just keep that in mind and then look at, you know, we talk in Buddhist meditation about all of the different mental afflictions. We have a lot of meditation techniques for dealing with it. We've got like anger management techniques, like how do we deal with anger from a Buddhist perspective. But I'll give you a secret. The one size fits all kind of solution for mental afflictions that I found so helpful when I'm in the throes of one, which is like all the time, you know, is to ask myself, what am I exaggerating? Because by definition, if your peace of mind is disturbed, you're exaggerating something. So that's kind of the one-size-fits-all solution. Now you have the answer, right now. What am I exaggerating? Because there's something about that situation you're distorting if it's bothering you. You know, yes, there may be things that are unpleasant about the situation, all of that, but it's like we make the suffering worse by the exaggeration and avoidance. Have you found that? It's like, even when you think that something bad is going to happen and you're already completely freaking out about it before it even happens and creating so much suffering before it's even happened, or just that, like, trying to get out of it while it's happening because you just think it's the end of the world when you're in the middle of it. So it's the exaggeration that's really the main thing that's the cause of suffering for us, not so much that things are pleasant or unpleasant. Like, if we can just roll with it and see things in a more balanced way and see them as impermanent. Because one of the things that we exaggerate, too, is, oh, my God, this is going to last forever. It's going to be so miserable, right? So it's like getting over the exaggeration of not seeing things in a balanced way, thinking it'll last forever, all of that is what we're really reacting to. Not so much the thing that's happening. So that's the kind of clue for the mental affliction. So any other questions about that, or the three poisons, or anything to... Wow, really? Nothing? That's unusual. You guys are all... you got it down.
On the aversion part, when you... This is a translator trying to make the question.
Yeah.
When you're rejecting something so much just for fear, just for fear that even something good, like getting a job or starting a new business or something, just to, like one of those cases, or it happened to me, like I start something and I kept everything to sell it, but then I'm afraid to go out and sell it.
Mm.
And you start rejecting it or making it excuses. Or
yeah.
It can be longer because you're so afraid of faith, something else. But it, even if it's going to be good for you, but you don't know because you're making a really old story.
Yeah.
You're afraid just to, you know.
And I think sometimes it's really helpful to kind of see where does the fear come from? Is it a fear of failing? Is it a fear of succeeding?
Both,
you know, we have fear of success too. And how much are we exaggerating? And what I find helpful is to play it out in my mind, like play out a scenario, imagine like the worst case scenario, or just kind of go there in my imagination. And it's generally really subdues whatever the fear, the aversion is. It's almost like I won't even let myself kind of think it through. I just sort of, you know, retreat from it. But if I really let myself think it through, then often I'm like, oh, well, that's not so bad. You know, often we're not even allowing ourselves to kind of think through it deeply. Another thing, too, is thinking about, is it triggering for you a fear because it kind of reminds you of something else that may have happened, like maybe something historically you tried to do something and failed, or something else happened, and then just separating, because sometimes our exaggeration is it's always going to happen to me.
Yeah, so it's happening again.
Yeah. And that's an exaggeration, too, because we don't know. We don't know. You know, and so I think really kind of, you know, acknowledging our emotions, acknowledging our fear, but also just saying, wow, I don't know that it's going to play out exactly the same way. And then sometimes I recommend to people trying something in kind of a low-risk situation, you know, to retrain yourself to kind of be brave again about whatever that situation is. Like, kind of think of something in a very low-risk situation to try it, to kind of retrain that avoidance and that aversion. And that might help. Yeah. Yeah, Susan.
You're alluding, at least the way I'm hearing that, you're alluding to how we can use meditation to work with aversion and...
Yeah.
And attachment. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so we can do it, and that's a great point. I think we can do it just in our imagination, but it's a great use of actual analytical meditation or conceptual meditation. You know, take a scenario in your life that you're either avoiding or afraid of or is triggering for you, and really kind of sit and analyze it from the safety of your meditation cushion before you go into that situation. I mean, this is a great way to use our meditation in a really practical way and apply some of the logic, apply some of the understanding, you know, to rehabituate. And in fact, the word for meditation in Tibetan comes from a root that means habituation or familiarization. So we're getting familiar with different ways of acting on the meditation cushion by imagining ourselves responding differently or imagining a different outcome. And then you find you kind of retrain yourself in the safety of, you know, the meditation session, so that when you're out there in that situation,
situation again, you respond differently. So that's a wonderful use of meditation. And in fact, you know, habituation, familiarization, I always say some people have the wrong view that meditation is just to have like a 20-minute oasis of calm in the middle of our crazy life. But it's to practice for the other 23 hours and 40 minutes of the day. That's what meditation is. It's practicing so that you'll respond differently off the cushion. And if it's not doing that, our meditation isn't really as effective as it could be. And so taking real life examples onto the cushion and really, yeah, what am I exaggerating? You know, is it attachment? How much is it love? How much attachment? What am I exaggerating about this situation? Do I have aversion just because my mind is exaggerating and going to the worst case scenario? What are the chances that that's going to happen? You know, all of that we go through that logic in our meditation session. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Yes.
I guess this kind of goes back to attachment and sort of aversion.
Yeah.
I'm reading this book called If the Buddha Dated. And I love the title, so I picked it up at a used
store.
So it's saying, I guess, tying the two attachment, it's on the opposite end of it, is that it's not that we're projecting the other person to be who we want, but really we're trying to mask ourselves of who we think the other person wants.
Mm-hmm.
And we get into that relationship, and at the end, if we lose that mask, then we end up risking losing the relationship, or if we stay in the mask, we risk losing ourselves. So I guess that brought me back to, you know, what I read from the book, and it's sort of the opposite end, the opposite side to the point of attachment, is that really it's not what you want from the other person, it's what you think they want from you, and you mask for it. So
right. And then it's so much energy, like such hard work to keep playing that character, you know, with the person, over and over and over again. And Buddhism, you know, we say in Buddhism, one of the main points is our happiness and suffering are not caused by external people, objects, and events. You know, and that's our root ignorance, is thinking that by getting what we want, pushing away what we think we don't want, all of that, you know, we'll live happily ever after. And so in Buddhism, in fact, I mentioned, I can't remember if it was in this group one of the times, but I think it was last week, maybe with you guys, we said the word, you know, the word Buddhist didn't really exist, but the word in Tibetan that refers to someone who's following the teachings of the Buddha is Nampa, which translates as something like inner being. So it's someone who's looking from within for the answers to happiness and suffering, not externally. So you can think of somebody like the Dalai Lama or Lama Yeshe, Four Seasons Hotel, Motel 6, no big deal, got a bed to sleep, you know, whatever. So it's not like looking outside of ourselves. So I think in relationships, we totally do that, don't we? And it's so, you know, it's so supported by our culture and all of the Hollywood movies and all of the fairy tales and billions of dollars of advertising industry telling us, you know, you're going to find your soulmate and then live happily ever after. So it's so conditioned. And Buddhism says, doesn't even work that way at all, you know? So many pitfalls in there that set us up for suffering. So I'll have to read that book.
I think it's on that bookshelf.
Is it?
Yeah,
it's great. I haven't read that book. Yeah, great. All right. So then we say, and this is, I'll just finish with a couple more things, and then we'll go before we delve into karma, because that's a hot topic. And, you know, I don't want to completely fry you guys' brain. So mental afflictions, those thoughts that are disturbing to our peace of mind, can then lead to karmic actions of body, speech, and mind. And I put the 10 non-virtues, which are an example of
you know, the negative karma. Oh, and by the way, we're focusing, because we're focusing on the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of suffering. Sorry, we're still focusing on the causes of suffering. Karma also creates the causes for our happiness. But for now, for the first part of our discussion, we're still kind of focusing on negative karma because we're talking about what the cause of suffering is. But when we start talking about karma next week, the laws of karma and the way that karma works, works for both positive and negative karma. So we'll start kind of making that shift. But for now, we're talking about non-virtues or negative karmas that are caused by the mental afflictions that lead to suffering results. Now, we can have a mind that's deeply unpeaceful and doesn't necessarily cause us to engage in any kind of negative action, right? So we can have, I mean, we do have minds filled, sorry guys, we do have minds filled with ignorance, like unless, and you could all be Buddhas, and I could be the only one that's not, and I have no idea. But if we're not yet Buddhas, we do have this ignorance. You know, until a very high level of realization, there is that dichotomy between the way things appear and the way they exist. And it takes a long time for that to close, that gap to close. And then mental afflictions are also arising kind of constantly, then sometimes generating negative karmic action that lead to suffering. Okay, so the arrow's going, this is the chain reaction of causation, but the chain reaction of stopping it kind of works in the reverse order, right? Easier to stop our actions than to control our mind, isn't it? So our first kind of line of defense is avoid the 10 non-virtues. There's a lot of Buddhist ethics, you know, different lay vows, monastic vows, bodhisattva, all these different vowed morality, but at least avoiding the 10 non-virtues, which are things like killing, stealing, lying, committing adultery, we'll go through that list, because that's easier than controlling our minds. So the way we work at reversing this is kind of from the bottom up, right? And then we work on the actual mental afflictions, those unpeaceful states of mind, and there are many meditation techniques that we use to subdue our minds, and then working at that ignorance, which takes a lot of deep meditation on the basis of a lot of deep study. So that one's harder to eliminate. So we're kind of working backwards. And you'll notice in your practice, if you start subduing your negative actions, your mind becomes more peaceful, right? In the Pali school of Buddhism, we talk about the three higher trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And ethics, pure ethics, is a support for being able to meditate well, right? Because if you're going around harming people and then sit down and try and meditate, yeah, see how that works out for you. You know, your mind is usually filled with regret. I'm a survivor of that. I went into long retreat, hadn't really cleaned up my ethical act, and just went into a spin out about 6 months into this long retreat of just crippling remorse, like unbelievable remorse. You know, I really realized how much I'd hurt people in my life. So pure ethics is a great platform for being able to meditate really, really well. Your mind is much more peaceful the less negative karmic actions you undertake. One friend of mine who's a Buddhist monk talks about the bliss of blamelessness. And I love that, right? Isn't that a great phrase? Because it's like the blissful mind that you get when you don't have a lot of regrets and remorse. So you're able to meditate well. And then that platform of really, really good meditation enables you to have those deep realizations into the nature of reality that combats that ignorance. So it builds on each other, kind of going backwards, right? That kind of ethics and pure morality enables you to be able to concentrate and meditate well, which enables you to have those deep realizations. But if you don't clean up your ethical act, not much progress, really. You know, you won't make a lot of progress on the spiritual path. So when we're going to look a lot at karma next week, and it's not, and, you know, some of the wrong views about karma is it's fate or destiny, or you're being punished somehow for what you did that was wrong. It's just smart to clean up your act karmically, because it will enable you to meditate well, and then enable you to get all the beautiful realizations of the path. Right? So when we look at our Buddhist practices, we can look at them in terms of eliminating one of these causes leading to suffering. Remember, we're not going to get here unless we've gone through all of those three steps. So we have all of these ethical, you know, kind of, what do you call it, recommendations in Buddhism, avoid the 10 non-virtues, take lay vows, you know, monastic vows are an option, all of that, working with the actions, and then a lot of the meditations that subdue the mental afflictions, and then the meditations on the ultimate nature of reality. So this is why I said, if we really understand this well, then our Buddhist practices make sense, because we can relate everything we do to getting rid of one of these components so that this is not going to happen. So it's awesome. It's very cool understanding this. And so what we'll do next week is unpack karma the next week, and then maybe into the week after that, because it's a big, big topic. Lots of details, lots to discuss there. And then we'll kind of carry on from there, talk about the goals of the spiritual path, and then talk about the path itself. Okay? So any final questions? That was a lot for tonight, and I think we can leave it at that. But any final questions about this chain reaction, anything about mental afflictions, ignorance? Are we good? Ish? And so your handout has a big section on the second noble truth. And so a lot of what I've talked about tonight is in there. You can review. And then we'll have some time to kind of have questions and anything that came up. I think for the next week, look at, notice when you're having mental afflictions, ask yourself, what am I exaggerating? That's your homework. So notice when those, even if it's just a very gradual, like that. I heard Pema Chodron speak once, long ago, about 20 years ago, when I met her for the first time and heard her speak, and she said one of her students came up to her, and by way of kind of a confession about how little she was sitting cross-legged on the meditation cushion, she goes, you know, my main practice is just looking at what comes up when someone walks towards me. And I was like, wow, that's so profound. Somebody walks towards you, you're just like, yeah, let's hang out. Somebody walks towards you, you're like, where's the door? Get me out of here, right? So just those, you know, very subtle attachment and aversion that comes up constantly in our lives, right? So just pay attention to that, you know, because it's not like, oh, I gave the extreme example, the horrible guy on the plane, or like the new boyfriend, but it's just that push-pull thing of attachment and aversion that sort of accompanies every moment of consciousness, pretty much. So notice the subtlety of that. And then when you have a major attachment or aversion attack over the next week, which pretty guarantees, sorry guys, you know, try that, you know, intervention of what am I exaggerating? Try that and see how that works. See if you can identify, yeah, there's something in there that I'm exaggerating. So that's your homework, and we'll talk about that next week. Alright. So what we're going to do is just sit for a minute and dedicate all of the positive energy that we've generated. This is how we kind of end our Buddhist teaching, thinking. We've generated all kinds of positive energy, as one of my friends calls it, spiritual momentum. And let's dedicate that towards our spiritual goals. Reflect for a moment on your intention that you set at the very beginning.
What are your reasons for coming here? What are your spiritual goals? Now we've generated some energy that we can put into that karmic bank account. And in the Tibetan Buddhist path, we emphasize a lot an altruistic intention that our spiritual practice, for sure it benefits us, there's no question. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But we also sincerely aspire through our own personal spiritual transformation to be of benefit to all living beings. So our own growth, our own transformation benefits not just us, but all sentient beings, all living beings. So take a moment to just generate that altruistic intention. Thank you all. See you next.